Arafat was forced to relocate the Fatah movement's headquarters. Lebanon was the first destination that Arafat chose to continue his fight against Israel. Although he had many opponents in Lebanon, his backers give him and this cause all-out support. Yet Arafat did not believe that Lebanon's support for the liberation of Palestine was enough. Arafat's trips around the world made headline news. He embarked on trips from Asia to Africa and from Africa to Europe to find new supporters. Only a few days after victory of the Iranian Revolution, he traveled to Iran and the first Palestinian embassy was established in Tehran in his presence. People in occupied Palestinian territories knew Arafat very well. He wanted to get the world on board in order to wrest back the occupied Palestinian territories and soon got what he was looking for. He traveled to New York and for the first time, a Palestinian speaks about Palestine to world leaders for an hour. And everyone gave him a standing ovation. Everyone but one group.
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
Recently, in an interview with Sky News, Britain's Foreign Secretary David Cameron criticized Iran for its military strikes against the Israeli regime, but hastened to add that the United Kingdom would have reacted similarly if one of its embassies had came under attack. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Iran's Press TV has covered this story and tells us more. The criticism against Britain's stance on Iran's retaliatory military operation against Israel gained momentum after British Foreign Secretary David Cameron's startling remarks. Recently, in an interview with Sky News, David Cameron harshly criticized Iran for its military strikes against the Israeli regime, but hastened to add that the United Kingdom would have reacted similarly if one of Britain's embassies had come under attack. Late on Saturday, 13th of April, Iran launched a barrage of drones and missiles directly against the occupied Palestinian territories in response to an earlier attack on the Iranian consulate building in Damascus, Syria, that led to the assassination of seven individuals, including three senior Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps commanders, RGC commanders. According to legal luminaries, The Israeli attack was in violation of international laws and the Vienna Convention of 1961, as embassies are considered the soil of that particular country. During the interview, when asked by Sky News journalists about how Britain would have reacted if one of its embassies was flattened, British Foreign Secretary David Cameron said, "We would take very strong action," drawing criticism from all across the world for UK's double standards on this matter. The 57-year-old former British Prime Minister David Cameron attempted to justify his remarks by differentiating between Israel's actions in Damascus and Iran's attack on the occupied Palestinian territories in response, highlighting the magnitude and scale of Iran's retaliation. David Cameron stressed there was a massive degree of difference between what Israel did in Damascus and Iran's unprecedented attack. "I would argue there is a massive degree of difference between what Israel did in Damascus and," as I said, referring to 301 weapons, 36 cruise missiles and 185 drones launched by Iran against military targets in the occupied Palestinian territories. While making the comparison, David Cameron struggled to differentiate between the Iranian and Israeli casualties in the attacks. The Israeli regime's attack against the Iranian embassy in Syria assassinated 7 people, while there have been no formal reports of any casualties in the Iranian attack on Israel. He also couldn't differentiate between the pre-attack warnings from both sides. Israel targeted the Iranian consulate building in Damascus without any prior warning, as the intention was to assassinate Iranian diplomats in breach of international laws, while the Iranian military intended to target the Israeli regime's military facilities. The British Foreign Secretary's remarks were widely criticised across social media platforms, with thousands of people condemning the British government for its blatant hypocrisy. Following the British Foreign Secretary's controversial comments on Sky News and his government's backing of the Israeli regime, the Iranian Foreign Ministry condemned the move, expressing astonishment at the British criticism of Iran's legitimate response to Israel's earlier attack on its embassy building in Damascus. In a telephone conversation on Monday, 15th of April, the Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian condemned David Cameron's stance and questioned Britain's unwavering support for Israel despite its illegal actions, including the daily massacring of Palestinian civilians in Gaza. The Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian asked David Cameron, "What does the British government gain from this amount of irresponsible support for Israel?" The top Iranian diplomat stressed that Iran's retaliatory measures align with the principle of legitimate defense outlined in Article 51 of the United Nations Charter. The foreign minister's exchange of remarks came after Iran's foreign ministry summoned the ambassadors of Britain, France, and Germany to question their irresponsible stance regarding Tehran's retaliatory strikes on the Israeli regime. The director for Western Europe at Iran's foreign ministry warned against the three countries' double standards and questioned their bias in opposing a UN Security Council statement condemning Israel's attack on Iran's embassy in Syria earlier in the month. The official added, "Iran's military action against the Zionist regime's bases is well within the framework of the right to legitimate defense stipulated in Article 51 of the United Nations Charter, and it is in response to a series of crimes, including the recent attack on Iran's embassy compound in Syria." Middle East Eye has also covered the same story and tells us more. The British Foreign Secretary's controversial comments about Iran were also met with criticism from George Galloway, a member of the British Parliament, who warned against the West's double standards on Israel and Iran. Exposing the inconsistency in Western attitudes, George Galloway said, if international standards were applied uniformly, then Western governments would have condemned Israel's blatant bombing of the Iranian embassy building in Damascus, Syria, and not just Iran's response to the Israeli regime's actions. The British MP George Galloway said, the mantra that Israel has a right to defend itself clearly does not apply to Iran. The mantra that there is a rules-based order and there is Vienna Convention protecting the inviolability of diplomatic premises of every country in every other country is clearly bunkum. George Galloway added, it doesn't apply to those that the Western Empire disapproves of, otherwise every Western government would have condemned Israel's blatant and brazen destruction of Iran's embassy in Damascus. They would have done it if it was anyone else, wouldn't they? Meanwhile, continuing its pivotal military support for the Israeli regime, British authorities claimed that the Royal Air Force, the RAF, came to the defense of the Israeli regime during last Saturday night's attacks. According to the British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak, as part of Operation Shader, the code name for British military intervention in West Asia since 2014, several British jets and air refueling tankers were dispatched to the region. Rishi Sunak claimed the RAF jets intercepted and brought down a number of Iranian drones. Speaking in the House of Commons on Monday, 15th of April, Prime Minister Sunak said, our pilots put themselves in harm's way to protect the Israeli regime and acknowledge the UK's contribution of important intelligence, surveillance and reconnaissance support for our partners. Britain's Defence Secretary Grant Shapps also confirmed the deployment of further military assets in the occupied Palestinian territories as a demonstration of solidarity with the Israeli regime. Grant Shapps was quoted as saying, in response to escalation in the region and in partnership with our allies, the Prime Minister and I have authorised the deployment of additional Royal Air Force assets. Britain is a staunch ally of Israel, supporting the Israeli regime with a raft of lethal arms. According to the figures by Campaign Against Arms Trade, the United Kingdom has authorised approximately £472 million worth of standard arms exports to Israel since 2015, alongside 58 open licenses of unlimited value, raising transparency issues and allowing unrestricted quantities of exports.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. To all our brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. This is IRIB English Radio. You are listening to Islamic Upbringing, where we discuss problems and questions parents have regarding the Islamic upbringing of their children. The answers that you'll be hearing today are mostly based on the book Children in the Quran and Sunnah, compiled by Ayatollah Shahri. And to help us with our questions, we have in the studio our guest speaker, Brother Miqdad, who is an Islamic researcher in the Hawza Ilmiyah of Qom. Assalamu alaikum, Brother Miqdad. We've had some very nice discussions with you. Thanks for showing up again.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah. I enjoyed it thoroughly as well. Thanks.
So we've been talking about how we can encourage our children to do right things and refrain from doing wrong things, considering that rationality isn't their most powerful feature, especially when they're under 8. We've been talking about various ways to do that, and the last element that we were talking about was storytelling. And in our previous program, we talked about the practical elements to a storytelling, like the specificity, like the words that we use, the vocabulary that we use. Remember that you said that the story should be completed, children cannot bear to be left in a suspense, and other elements like that. Let's start today by examining the rest of the elements that we need to consider when we're telling stories to our children.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. We talked about how to use the right words, words that are simple for children to understand. We talked about how to make sure that the sentences are small, that they're linked together properly in a way that is very quick to the children can quickly understand it. They don't have to think about it too much. We talked about how the tune and the body language is extremely important, the voice change that we do to ensure that we are in sync with the story, basically, of the content of the story. Right, so this is a huge, I don't want to open up over here, but there's so much we can talk about, right? For example, when you're saying a story and the story is something to do something fast, then you make you speed up the way you speak saying it, right? The horse was going really fast, right? But when you talk about something that's happening very slow,
you slow down.
Suddenly he came to his friend and he started talking to him very slowly.
We also talked about, I remember, making the voices of the animals, or if any sound is actually there, replicating that sound.
Definitely, yeah. Replicating sound is very good as well. You're making the story very alive. One of our teachers was saying that he was challenging the crowd he was speaking to. I think one of the questions was about animations and cartoons. So you're saying you can put a TV on one side of the room, okay, and I'll be sitting on the other side of the room, and I promise you, he challenged everyone that if you put 10 kids on that side watching TV, okay, I'll say stories over here, and I challenge you that all 10 of them will be with me at the end of the show, listening to my stories and abandoning the TV. And for some parents, it might be very surprising that isn't that even possible to get my children out of the screen. But the way he was saying that, the way we need to do stories is to make them very alive. And this is by making these noises, by making these changes in the tone of the voice and in the body language, etc. Another thing that we talked about was to involve children in the story as well. This especially for stories that you repeat, that are repeated stories. Now, in bracket, let me mention something over here, is that children, especially when they're very young, when they're 3, 4, 5, they love to hear stories over and over and over again, the same story, right? You could play this, if it's a very good story, they probably want to hear it every single night for the next month and a half or two. Right, and they won't get tired. You might be tired, you might get fed up of listening to that story, but they don't. They want to repeat it and again and again and again. And there's pleasure in that for them, right? But one of the things that you could do is when the story is known by them, after a few times you've played, then they know the story, then is to involve the children in the story. So let them do part of the story. Let them, for example, make the noise of the horse, or for example, let them do the voice of Amir al-Mu'mineen, for example. Make them part of the story. This really makes the story much fun, much more lively for them, and makes them feel much more in control of as well. And that really builds the role model aspect as well.
Okay, I'm going to have to stop you there, but we'll be back after the break to examine more elements when we're telling stories. Stay tuned.
Hey, stop! I got a better game!
IRIB English Radio presents a priceless gift to parents. Do you have problem with your kids?
I have two boys. One is 5 years old and the other one is 3.5. And they
constantly fight and wrestle with each other, and it often gets to a dangerous stage.
My 18-month-old daughter has learned to eat by herself, and she just refuses that I feed her. But usually, all the food basically goes everywhere except her mouth. So how can we allow this strife to happen for the purpose of freedom?
Don't worry. We're here to help.
For a child, the purpose of the food is only to feed. It's also for him to learn. It's also for him to explore and fulfill the need of curiosity, fulfill the need of freedom.
Islamic upbringing. Contact us. English radio at irib.ir.
You're back on IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran. This is Islamic Upbringing. We're with Brother Maghdad. We're talking about the various elements that we should consider when we are telling stories to children. So keep the sentences short, involve the children, have proper body language, sync your tune with the story, and it's okay if the children ask you to repeat a story 100 times, they'll enjoy it. What else should we consider about storytelling?
One point about involving children, allowing them to speak during the story as well, is very important. You know, sometimes you wonder why do grandmas or uncles are much more closer to children, especially, I mean, children love being around their grandmothers or around their uncles and aunties. One of the reasons is that because they listen to them, right? Parents usually tend to say, you know, be quiet, we've spoken a lot today. I've got a lot of things to do, stop talking, right? It's enough now. But the same children, when they go to the uncle, then it's normal to some extent because they're going to see the uncle for an hour, right? And the uncle or the auntie or the grandma is very happy to see them. So they're going to allow them to speak. And children, they feel really respected because they're allowed to speak and they're listened to, basically. So when we do stories, it's good to listen. Sometimes children have questions and then children want to interrupt and say, how about we do it different way? Sometimes they want to do the story themselves. They want to carry on the story. It's good to allow them this freedom to say it and to express themselves and to listen to them attentively.
That does actually kind of point to one of the questions that I wanted to ask. At some point, we might want our children to change the story to their liking in order to invoke their creativity. But if it's a story about the history of Islam, they will be diverting that story from its reality. Is that okay to let them do that?
So if it's a real story that happened, then no, it's not okay to completely change it. But you can have some additions that don't really matter to the story too much, right? So for example, inshallah, I'll mention the story that, for example, if Kumail, the companion of Amir al-Mu'min, is sitting in the mosque, for example, and Amir al-Mu'min grabs his hand and says, let's go out, right? Now, if your child wants to say, it was really, really dark, and the moon was out, right? And when they walked, for example, Kumail just tripped on something, right? It's fine, right? It's a kind of details that don't really have an impact on the story that we want to tell. And actually makes it more lively, makes it more real.
So we were saying that sometimes it's okay that the children might want to take over and narrate the stories themselves, and yeah, that's okay for them to do, let them interact.
Another thing that really helps when you do this is that you appreciate how much they've understood as well. Sometimes children, if you want to test if children got the message of the story or not, rather than asking them directly, did you understand the story? And they'll say, yes, we understood. Or asking them, what did you learn from the story? You ask them to repeat the story. And when they repeat the story, you realize which part they really took in, and that's the word they're going to say, and which part they forgot and they put it aside. Another thing about stories is to sometimes act them out, right? By using different kind of tools around us. One of the parents was saying that when they were doing the story of Imam Ali in the Battle of Khandaq, the Battle of Ahzab, the name is, and when Amir al-Mu'minin fought one of the strongest soldiers on that side, they took two chairs and pretended that they were on the horse, basically, right? You act it out, basically, and that children really appreciate that. And that really helps make the story go in. Stories is something that children will never forget. If you want to teach them something that they don't forget, it's through stories. And up until now, I'm sure a lot of us remember, if I ask you one of the lectures that you heard as an adult, if I tell you about the last lecture that you listened to, you probably remember the story that was mentioned in that lecture more than all the rest of the content. So Stories really help, and the more we make it lively, the more we make it reach the heart, the goal of the story will be reached.
And when we're talking about, specifically when we're talking about appreciating and acknowledging a child's understanding of the story, at this age, under 10, would it be appropriate to ask them what they learned from the story and how they can apply it to their real life?
You could, but it's always best to let them do it themselves, right? If you point it out too much, it turns into a school lesson, right? And children don't necessarily want to constantly be told what to do or not to do. And so they won't appreciate so much if after every story I have to tell you what's the right thing, what's the wrong thing, etc. Allow the worldview of the story, the very strong etiquettes of the story to sink in their hearts without being noticed. Sometimes it doesn't need to be noticed. It'll play in their mind themselves. And when the time comes for that to be adapted or applied in practical life, it will naturally come out.
All right, thank you very much. We're going to come after the break. Don't go away.
Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam said, O nation of Shia, teach your children the poems of Al-Abdi, because he was a follower of the religion of Allah.
You're back on IRIB English Radio, broadcasting from Iran. This is Islamic Upbringing, and we are with Brother Miqdad. We're talking about storytelling to children. So up to now, we've been talking about telling stories of Islamic history in order to acquaint our children with Islamic identity. What if we want to teach them about Islamic values? And the question that I want to ask specifically is that since these are stories that are made up, would it be appropriate for us to use the heroes that children have in the animations that they see on television, like Ben 10 and whatever, in order to tell them a story about Islamic values?
So if you remember that in the past show that we specifically mentioning that the real reason that we want to use stories is to make the Ahlul Bayt as role models for our children. And we said that one of the best ways, or perhaps the most efficient way, to get our children to learn about Islam and to become strong followers of the Ahlul Bayt and to become true servants of Allah, which is the goal of their creation, is through the path of role modeling, right? As we mentioned that if you want a 9-year-old girl to wear hijab, okay, you can sit her down and explain to her that if you wear hijab, this is, Islam says this, it's because you'll be more respected or because this, and you can give her like 5-6 arguments for it, right? But if this child has Bibi Fatima as a role model, all you need to say is that, do you know what? Bibi Fatima used to wear her hijab, and that's it. Just the way that you have one, I don't know, a football player, for example, who makes one hairstyle and suddenly thousands of people have the same hairstyle without even asking, does this even look good, right? There's a 100% following to that person because he's a role model. Similarly, Islam has introduced for us role models, and we have this in the Holy Quran, that and through the role models, we get our children to become really good, strong followers of the Ahlul Bayt. So the real reason of stories is to get them to follow the Ahlul Bayt, and therefore we stick to the stories that are related to the Ahlul Bayt.
And in 30 seconds, can you answer this question? Should our parents be investing in criticizing these animations that are not related to the Ahlul Bayt?
In one sense, no, because if you do spend more time on the Ahlul Bayt, the rest will just fly away and fade away by itself.
Okay, thank you very much. That's even shorter than 30 seconds, which is great. That's all the time that we have, unfortunately. But if you missed the program, you can always download an archive of this episode and previous ones from our website. Simply visit parstoday.com. That's parstoday.com. And find our page on Call of Islam. And you can email us at englishradio@irib.ir, englishradio@irib.ir. Until next episode, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Islam solves all of its problems, Allah leaves no stone unturned, perfect with no flaws at all, are the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way, it's a complete way.
option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
A Window to Palestine.
Soy Daniel Jadwe.
I am Daniel Jadwe, a citizen of Chile, originally from Palestine. Born like so many other Palestinians around the world in the diaspora, Chile has one of the largest communities outside the Arab world. It is said that we are close to 300,000, but we are millions spread across the face of the earth, far from our homeland, but committed to the identity, history, and struggle of our people, of our land, which is and will forever be Palestine.
Hola, bienvenidos y bienvenidas.
Hello and welcome to the program. Today we are witnessing a genocide in Palestine, but this did not start on October the 7th. It is part of a plan that was born more than 125 years ago with a perfectly studied and planned colonization process. Today we will talk about how Palestine has been changed and how the occupation has changed the life of this territory and the entire area that surrounds it. Let's analyze and have a deeper look into this issue. Indeed, more than 100 years ago, they began to arrive as victims of the pogroms of Tsarist Russia, and years later, the Nazi Holocaust. But shortly after they were received with open arms of solidarity with their pain, they began to show their true face, to expropriate the Palestinians, to destroy their villages, to destroy their ancient olive plantations, to keep absolutely everything, destroying schools and houses and any vestige of the territory's history. Let's see below the following report by our correspondent in Gaza, Hoda Hijazi.
Before the aggression on the Gaza Strip on October 7th, the Israeli cabinet had approved new plans to build thousands of homes in illegal settlements in the occupied West Bank. According to international law, the construction of these settlements is illegal and constitutes an obstacle to peace. However, this decision occurred amid an increase in violence by settlers and the occupation army in the Palestinian territories, and this was one of the reasons that caused the Operation Al-Aqsa flood to break out.
The construction of Israeli settlements in the Palestinian territories and in occupied Jerusalem Al-Quds is an illegal, illegitimate act and condemnable. Under no circumstances can the permanence of these settlements be supported, since they do not agree with the norms of international law in general. The only solution is to put an end to these settlements.
According to Palestinian sources, this Israeli war has been one of the most brutal in history, which has caused the destruction of more than 70% of the structures in the Gaza Strip. Given this, the Israeli minister Itamar Ben-Gvir assured that the massacre in Gaza is an opportunity to develop a project that will encourage Gazan residents to immigrate to other countries in the world. This is in addition to the solution proposed by the Minister of Finance, Bezalel Smotrich, which encourages the voluntary immigration of the citizens of Gaza and in fact depopulate the area of Palestinians.
They're trying to bomb all the places, displace people by force. They say that this is a voluntary displacement, but in reality it is not. The displacement is due to the crimes of the occupation, the deliberate and systematic bombing of civilians. They even bomb areas where the displaced people live. This is a forced displacement of citizens under armed pressure, including planes and tanks, as well as a psychological and media impact with a war waged against the Palestinian people.
The reports released by the UN indicate a very significant increase in violent incursions by Israeli settlers in the West Bank cities since October 7th. This has caused the death of a record number of Palestinians. This is also considered an integral part of the Zionist plan that seeks to completely dispossess Palestinians of their land.
The attack on Palestinian citizens in the cities of the West Bank, Jerusalem, Al-Quds, or even inside occupied Palestine is considered a crime in every sense. This is a political cost for Netanyahu's cabinet, along with Ben-Gvir and Smotrich. They have decided to give the settlers the green light to do whatever they want with the objectives of invading and the Judaization that the settlers are carrying out, including the raids on the Al-Aqsa Mosque. This is actually one of the reasons that led to the outbreak of the Operation Al-Aqsa Flood. Therefore, the cost for the cabinet of Netanyahu, who is now appeasing the settlers after giving them the green light, is very high.
There are a large number of Gazans who have decided to stay in their homes and not go out despite the great danger to their lives. However, they have decided to resist and not allow a second Nakba to take place. This is another act of resistance by the Palestinian population. It is to continue showing the world the crimes committed by the Israeli regime. A large number of journalists and media workers have been murdered for the simple fact of being eyes of the truth and reporting Israel's actions.
The way to confront this occupation is to stay alive and rebuild any place that is being destroyed. Today, every Palestinian citizen who has a mobile phone is now able to broadcast through social media and expose this occupation by spreading the truth about everything. The painful truth is that in the past month, we've seen that journalists are being attacked because they wanted to show the true image of the occupation. They've also become a target for exposing the crimes of the occupation in front of the Arab and international community.
Despite the constant crimes committed by the Israeli regime in Gaza and other Palestinian territories, the world continues to fold its arms and do nothing to stop this massacre. For 75 years, Palestinians have lived under Israeli occupation. During all these decades, it has been carrying out the most atrocious crimes against the Palestinian population. Now, again in the 21st century, and in the face of silence from the international community, the Zionists seek to expel the Gazans from their territories to take control of the rest of Palestine. Huda Hejazi, Gaza, Palestine.
Los habitantes actuales de la Franja de Gaza.
The current inhabitants of the Gaza Strip, depending on their age, have been forcibly displaced between one and three times over the last 75 years. It all began in 1897 at the first Zionist Congress in Basel, Switzerland, when Theodor Herzl presented to a tiny part of the world Jewry their project to rebuild the regime of Israel from the Nile to Euphrates, the founding myth of being part of the chosen people and this being the promised land. We thank our correspondent in Gaza, Huda Hejazi, and I invite you to stay tuned because in the next section we will be talking with a very special guest.
Bien, ya estamos de regreso y
well, we are back, and in this section we're going to talk with Silvana Rabinovich, who is a researcher at the Philological Research Institute of the National Autonomous University of Mexico.
Gracias, Silvana, por haber aceptado esta invitación.
Thank you, Silvana, for accepting this welcome invitation. I want to ask you a question that many are asking in the current context with this ongoing genocide. At what point in this historical development of the Zionist project are we, and how far do they intend to go?
Well, first of all, I really appreciate the invitation. I'm very honored. Well, I want to mention points about the colonial and national colonial political theology of Israel. I think that from that point of view, we've reached the moment when the last apocalyptic mooring is loose. And when we talk about the Zionist project, I think we have to also take into account Christian Zionism, which is very interested in this apocalypse for the second coming of Christ. And well, I believe that there is no return to this. There was already genocide in progress there, but now we're witness to an accelerated genocide. It's been unleashed. And I'm surprised by the reception it has among the Israeli population, even those that claim to be progressive, and even among former conscientious objectors who today have decided, at age 40 and a half, for example, to enroll in this massacre, this genocide. That is extremely worrying because it's an attitude that was growing and deepening. And in this case, there really was no difference between the different administrations in Israel, whether those assumed to be left-wing, which can be discussed, or those on the right regarding the settlements. We're, of course, focused on Gaza, which is something atrocious, and it is difficult to understand why the entire world does not rise up against the genocide there. Well, some governments around the world, or rather nations, have taken actions. In other words, the siege that surprised the Israelis on October 7th is being constantly documented. That, of course, it is very scary that they will take you out of bed and arrest you. But it happens. As Haggai Matar, the director of Plus 92 magazine, said, it happens every day there. Just one letter signed by 669 Israelis in support of South Africa's claim before the International Court of Justice is all that was achieved from the entire population, considering even those who did not vote for this administration, those who took to the streets to protest against Netanyahu. That really catches my attention. They hid themselves under the cloak of what that assures them of collective suicide with what they consider the enemy.
After the first Zionist Congress in 1897, there was talk of Israel from the Nile to the Euphrates. In 1948, they accepted, of course, the partition of Palestine, but declared that it was a first step. Then in 1967, in the misnamed Six-Day War, they occupied the entire Palestinian territory and some areas of the Syrian Golan Heights and Lebanon, in where the Zionist project is going.
¿Dónde para el proyecto sionista?
A ver, el proyecto sionista, yo quisiera hacer un poquito de historia.
Let's see, the Zionist project. It goes back a little bit to history, because from the first Zionist Congress to the ones that followed, there was a lot of discussion there. And there were voices that did not agree at all with this form of foreign colonialism in the region and typically European version, nor with the fact of considering the original inhabitants of the land as enemies. I mean, in 2006, I translated Martin Buber's political text, and there was a whole movement, a movement that was against it. Let's see. In 1946, when the Anglo-American Commission went to Palestine to see if the land was actually divided or not, which was carried out on November the 29th, 1947, they disobeyed the leadership of the Jewish population of Palestine. Martin Buber, Yehuda Magnus, and Moshe Slimansky. They all arrived and convinced the Anglo-American Commission that the land should not be divided, that there should be neither one nor two national states, but a confederation of autonomous communities from the part of Greater Syria. So within the Zionist movements, there were also these positions which were all the time denouncing the demographic and expansionist ideas as deeply contradictory with the love of the land, with the possibilities of coexistence that existed. However, well, we see now that not a bit of that remains. That was present until 1948, and all the years that Martin Buber was still alive, Martin Buber continued fighting to protect, to protest the properties, the rights of the Palestinian population. Of course, he died in 1965. He no longer saw 1967. He did not see all that expansionist fever, absolutely foreign to the culture of the region. I would also like to point to the time of the secularization of the Hebrew language. Yehuda proposed and practiced this secularization of the language, which was much discussed due to the connotations it later had, which we are seeing now in its worst moment and in its worst version. He said that the words that had to be completed from so many countries, that the Hebrew language had to be confined to the ritual religious sphere, had to be completed from Arabic, which was the closest language, the most sisterly, and the one of the place. But well, the Zionist leadership is doubly Eurocentric. It is Eurocentric in Central Europe, and it used the Jews of Arab countries as human shields to carry out this project, which, as Theodor Herzl, the founder of Zionism, said, had to have its function be the retaining wall that prevents Eastern barbarism from entering Europe. And well, this is what we're seeing now, and it is in its worst phase, of course.
Thank you, Silvana. Now I'm going to give way to the audience. They have two questions they want to ask you. Please.
Por favor.
Hola, mi nombre es Janigeria.
Hello, my name is Jangeria. I am a philosophy professor, also of Palestinian descent in Chile. I wanted to ask you the following question. I wanted to know what you think about the biblical names that the Israelis use for both the use of weapons and also the military campaigns that they carry out, precisely in a land that we know has that connotation.
Gracias, Hani. Eso es justamente el tema que yo más trabajo.
Thanks. That is precisely the topic that I work on the most. I mean, the abusive ways in which the biblical text and biblical figures are used to name these campaigns weapons. And well, it has a purpose that Netanyahu recently reminded us of when he spoke of Amalek, which is that people who must be exterminated according to God for having abused the weakest at the exit from Egypt. Something that one says now. Well, the one who is playing the role of Amalek is the Netanyahu administration and not the people of Gaza whom he's trying to annihilate. This happens in Rafael Industries. What's happening? From the name Rafael, since it is actually an acronym, to each of the names of the campaign. I've detailed this in my book, The Drone Bible, about such abuses and the abuses of biblical figures in Israel's political discourse. I believe that in the Bible, there are two sources. One is monarchical and the other one is prophetic. The prophetic sets limit to the monarchic. Obviously, the one that prevails is the monarchic in a European sovereignist version. And what it seems to me is that the Bible is needed precisely to evoke the limiting forces that the prophetic sources set.
The limit que ponía la la fuente profética.
Hola.
Hello, my name is Carmen Mendoza. I am an international journalist, and I would like to know who are the settlers, where do they come from, and what role have they played and are playing in the occupation of Palestine?
Gracias por la pregunta, Carmen. Los colonos.
Thanks for the question, Carmen. Let's see. The settlers, many of them, are Zionist immigrants, very convinced of this expansionist vision that Daniel described at the beginning. They tend to come from the United States and France and also other places. There are, of course, Israelis born there, of course, but it is striking how they are people who have emigrated to occupy the land, to radically carry out this ethnic cleansing
to the point of genocide, and which is also manifested in the siege. There are Israeli organizations that seek to protect the settlers, especially Area C. But the truth is that Area A, similar to Area B and Area C, are constantly besieged by the army. On June the 8th, 50 armored cars poured into Ramallah just to destroy the apartment of someone who was there in jail in Israel in Area A. So this form of presence is what they call showing presence. It makes the settlers feel completely free to commit all kinds of crimes. Even the last administration has greatly encouraged them to be armed with heavy weapons. Even teenagers who go to school armed with heavy weapons. So let's say there is a debasement, a civil debasement at the beginning. Now, deepening of this debasement is enormous, and they are very convinced settlers and young people. I went to the Jordan Valley accompanying a group of Israeli retirees who defend the shepherds so that they can graze. What happened was that two young boys of about 16 years old went down with their cows to destroy the wheat fields with their tiny tractors to scare the sheep. In other words, there is a siege. There is a constant siege, and there are, of course, young people born there, but also very right-wing, as well as convinced Zionists who emigrate to precisely what they call badly, very badly, Judaize the land. This is what we see in the Jerusalem area, the Greater Jerusalem Project, right? But we shouldn't also forget about what's happening in the worst of the lowest in Hebron, which is Al-Khalil.
La peor de las más bajas en Hebrón, que es Al-Khalil.
Muchas gracias, Silvana.
Thank you very much, Silvana, for accepting our invitation. What you say is absolutely true. Here in Chile, there is a Hebrew Institute that in one of its last years makes study trips to the occupied territories, and there they do a course of almost a week called Gatna, where they teach Chilean citizens how to use weapons wearing Israeli army uniform. And that, incredibly, is legal. I thank you very much for your participation, and let's take a break.
Y vamos a una pausa, ya regresamos.
Dear listeners, that was the first part of A Window to Palestine. You can listen to the second part tomorrow.
In the limelight.
In Britain, ministers are facing a revolt from their own Conservative MPs over plans to criminalise homelessness in the upcoming legislation. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Sky News has covered this story and tells us more. Rough sleeping could be fully decriminalised after 200 years on the proposals from rebel Conservative MPs to repeal legislation dating from the aftermath of the Napoleonic Wars. A group of Tory MPs working with UK's Labour and Liberal Democrat MPs want to strip out proposed and existing legislation that criminalises homelessness. The revolt is focused on government plans to introduce harsher policing of rough sleepers in its crime bill. Under proposals announced by the former UK Home Secretary Suella Braverman, police in England and Wales are to be given powers to fine or move on rough sleepers deemed to be causing a nuisance for the public. The move has infuriated MPs across the Conservative Party. Several dozen MPs are supporting proposals by Bob Blackman, the Tory MP coordinating the rebellion, to remove parts of the bill that criminalise rough sleeping and repeal the 200-year-old Vagrancy Act. The combined effect of these proposals, if passed, would be to fully decriminalise rough sleeping. The government has committed to repealing the Vagrancy Act of 1824, which was introduced to target wounded soldiers who began begging on the streets of England after returning from the Napoleonic Wars as homeless and destitute. However, ministers have yet to announce a date for the act to be repealed, and campaigners say that in its current form, the Criminal Justice Bill would go even further. According to the data collected by the local government expert Jack Shaw, almost 4,000 people have been arrested under the vagrancy laws in the 5 years to 2023. Conservative MP Bob Blackman said aspects of the proposed bill, under which rough sleepers could be moved on, fined up to £2,500 or imprisoned, were outrageous and worse than the Vagrancy Act. He added, the police should assist people who are homeless to find somewhere that they can stay safely rather than arrest them and put them in a prison cell. Bob Blackman added, what we've got to make sure of is that we consign the Vagrancy Act to the history book, not the statute book, and ensure that people are assisted to find somewhere to live. Nikki Aiken, the Tory MP for Cities of London and Westminster and a long-standing campaigner against the Vagrancy Act, said, I've been working with Bob Blackman on the amendment and it's ridiculous to think that we should criminalise rough sleepers today. How are they going to pay their £2,500 fine? They need proper services addressing the reasons why they're on the street, not a criminal record. Matt Downey, the chief executive of homelessness charity Crisis, said, if these amendments pass, and they appear to have cross-party support from huge numbers of people in the Parliament, they would have the effect of finally moving on from 200 years of punitive and cruel interventions that stop people accessing the help that they need and punish them for their circumstances. On Monday, 1st of April, Kevin Hollenrake, a business minister, refused to say whether he supported the plans. He told Times Radio, I believe that those things are not within my auspices. I'll be interested to see the legislation as it goes through Parliament and what the Prime Minister has planned. The Times, which first reported the story, said about 40 MPs had made it known to government whips that they would vote against the proposals to criminalise rough sleepers. The former Conservative leader Ian Duncan Smith and Damien Green, the One Nation caucus chair, are among those who have joined the rebellion. Critics say the legislation is so broadly drawn that someone could be considered a nuisance for sleeping in a doorway, being deemed to have an excessive smell, or looking as though they intend to sleep rough. Ministers are in talks with the rebels over a possible compromise before the bill returns to the House of Commons after the Easter recess. Alex Norris, the Shadow Policing Minister, said, with soaring serious violence, plummeting charging rates and rock-bottom levels of confidence in policing, the Criminal Justice Bill was a chance to address crucial community safety issues. Instead, the government has chosen to go after homeless people or indeed anyone who smells. These are the twisted priorities of a government out of time. The Liberal Democrat MP, Leila Moran, said, the heartless proposals in the Criminal Justice Bill risk bringing back the Vagrancy Act by the back door. The government should listen to their own backbenchers and take a compassionate approach to tackle homelessness instead of stigmatizing and criminalizing those who sleep rough. The British newspaper The Guardian has also covered the same story and tells us more. British ministers are facing a revolt from their own Conservative MPs over plans to criminalise homelessness in the upcoming legislation. Under proposals that form part of the British government's flagship crime bill, police in England and Wales are to be given powers to fine or move on rough sleepers deemed to be causing a nuisance to the public. The move has infuriated many Conservative MPs, about 40 of whom have warned whips that they will vote against the measure. Rob Blackman, the Conservative MP who is coordinating the rebellion, told The Guardian, "A lot of colleagues believe that the bill as it stands is completely unacceptable because it would have the effect of criminalising people who have no choice but to sleep on the streets. We are urging ministers to think again. The proposals form part of the Criminal Justice Bill, which is going through the House of Commons and is due to become law before the general election. They were announced by the former Home Secretary, Suella Braverman, and would give police and local authorities powers to act against nuisance rough sleepers in England and Wales. Rough sleepers could be moved on, they could be fined up to £2,500 or even imprisoned." Senior Conservative MPs on the left and right of the party, including the former Conservative leader Ian Duncan Smith and the One Nation Caucus chair Damien Green, have signed amendments to legislation to remove the plans